Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, folks, you love us, and I hope you love Amazon. I'm a customer. Well, here's a great way to shop at Amazon while supporting Wolfpop. Instead of going directly to Amazon, go to wolfpot.com/Amazon. That'll take you to the same Amazon you know and love, and all the prices will be the same as they always are, but we'll get a sweet, sweet kickback, and that helps everybody. You, me, Baron, everybody here. Give it a try. wolfpop.com/Amazon, and we thank you. Hello, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin, and this is Maltin on Movies with Baron Vaughn.
I'm the other guy.
Well, that would be Baron Vaughn.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And we are here. We are here to talk about today remakes. Not the happiest subject if we're going to generalize about movies. You know, it's a sorry state of affairs that every 10 years, 20 years, Hollywood feels a kind of an imperative to rehash, retread, redo what they've done before. And, you know, the odds are not in their favor, are they?
No. I mean, usually remakes are, people go, ah, why are they remaking that? That's usually what I hear people say when a remake is coming out.
There were two recent ones that I think were very interesting case studies, because in both instances, the films themselves weren't bad.
Okay.
But there was so little interest in them because the potential audience knew the originals so well. One was Footloose.
Yes, right.
And there was nothing terribly wrong with the new Footloose. I saw it.
Yeah.
But everybody knows the original. So that was like kids, young people, they see it on cable. They stream it. They have DVDs of it.
It's one of those movies that's a rite of passage to this day. At some point at 12, you will see Footloose.
Yeah. So nobody cared about seeing a new Footloose. And I think much the same happened with the new Karate Kid.
The one with Jaden Smith.
Yeah.
And Jackie Chan,
mm-hmm.
which took place in China, and karate is Japanese.
Please, details.
Two different? Okay.
Don't bring details to the table here. But I think that's what happened there, too, to a very real degree.
Mm.
They didn't do a bad job with it. It went on too long. But they didn't do a bad job with it. But nobody needed or wanted a new Karate Kid. That's my theory. You can tear it apart if
Absolutely.
You like. And then, there are the world's worst remakes. There are films like Gus Van Sant's remake of Psycho, which just –
With Vince Vaughn, right?
Oh,
shot by shot remakes, apparently.
Yes, supposedly shot for shot, except for the masturbation scene and things
no,
like
that. No, no, no. Hitchcock just left that on the cutting room floor. I mean, the last four letters of his last name. I don't need to bring that up.
And then that unfortunate remake that Jonathan Demme did of The Manchurian Candidate.
Yes, which is one of my favorite movies. I mean, the original, John Frankenheimer.
Yeah. The blah remake of Total Recall.
Ugh, which I saw in the theaters. Mm-hmm. Lynn Wiseman, you might know him from Underworld, which is why Kate Beckinsale was in that.
Mm-hmm. Even the remake of Carrie. There's a remake of Poltergeist playing in theaters right now
that I didn't
even get to see, and I'm not sorry about that. But there have been good remakes. And if you go back into history and you look at some of the best films of the 30s and 40s, it turns out that many of them are remakes of hit silent movies. Hollywood went through a whole cycle then. Everything's cycles.
Yeah.
Everything is cycles.
Cycles are cyclical.
One of my favorite movies of all time is The Maltese Falcon, John Huston's great, great film, his writing and directing debut with Humphrey Bogart and a great, great cast. Well, that was the third time around for The Maltese Falcon.
That's the only one I've seen.
The first one from 1931 is actually quite good. The Awful Truth, one of the great screwball comedies, had been filmed before in the early talkie era.
With Cary Grant and Ralph Bellamy, we're going to talk about them a little bit more.
Waterloo Bridge, one of the great Hollywood romances, had been filmed before. The Four Feathers, the ultimate British rah-rah imperial boys' adventure, had been filmed before. Captain Blood, which made Errol Flynn a star, had been a silent film hit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's no rules here. There's no rule that says a remake can't be really good. A lot of people love The Fly, David Cronenberg's version of The Fly, and it's certainly a better and more ambitious film than the tacky little B-movie that came out in the late 50s. And, you know, there are many examples, pro and con, but on the whole, they tend not to work out so well.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with we're remaking movies that were already popular when they came out.
Yes.
Then they were remaking movies that just didn't find their thing, or they were just a little under the radar.
Right.
And someone who was a good director or writer decided, I'm going to take this idea and turn it into something good. Whereas we're trying to take things that are good and then turn them into something better.
Right.
But it never works.
I was at a press conference with John Huston where someone asked him about remakes. There had been some grumblings. about a remake of, I think, The Asphalt Jungle. And he said, well, he says, I'd rather they remade some of my flops.
Of course.
Films that didn't turn out well. You know, let them remake those and turn them into better movies.
That's what Soderbergh says to do.
Yeah. Oh, well. But we're going to show you that every rule has its exceptions. Because we're going to talk about two really good remakes. One vintage, one a classic. Golden Age of Hollywood.
Didn't even know it was a remake.
Right. One contemporary, and then one that didn't turn out so hot.
Yeah. That's the newest of the three, the not so hot one.
So we're going to start with a great, did I mention great Hollywood movie?
I think there's another great in there.
As many as you like.
Yeah.
One of the greatest and certainly one of the funniest movies ever made, His Girl Friday.
Still funny.
From 1940. It sure is. Funny. And it's a remake of The Front Page. It's based on the great newspaper play, the 1929 newspaper play by Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur called The Front Page, which had been turned into a good movie in 1931 with Pat O'Brien and Adolphe Manjou and a great, great cast.
Okay.
And but the story goes that director Howard Hawks, and this is a story, no one has proof. No one has evidence. And even Hawks biographer Todd McCarthy said there's no way of pinning this down. But apparently, as Hawks told it, he was at a party one night. And as just for the fun of it, someone had the play script of The Front Page. Said, let's read it. That's a great – let's read it. And they gathered, you know, a bunch of talented people.
Before television.
Right? They amused themselves. Only just for the fun of it, they had a woman read the leading role. And the leading – I think his the character's name was Hildebrand or something like that. And they changed it to Hildy, which is what his nickname was first time around. So they had a woman play Hildy, the intrepid reporter who's trying to quit the business. And everyone there said, hey, that works. And that adds a different dynamic, an entirely new dynamic, a new ingredient to what is already a great play. And that's where the idea – was born for a gender switch remake of The Front Page. And that became this film with Rosalind Russell at her best, one of the great comedians of all time, at her best, playing Hildy Johnson, a star reporter who is going to quit and get married.
Right. And she's the ex-wife of Cary Grant's character who runs Walter Banks?
Yeah.
Who runs the newspaper that she used to work for.
Yes, and still works for, actually, at the opening of the film.
Technically.
Yes. And so Walter, who Cary Grant, who never shirks from a fight or a challenge and who is totally unscrupulous, has no scruples whatsoever.
Anything to get the story.
Personally or professionally. He's not going to let her go. He's not going to let her get married, certainly not without a fight. And that's the basic idea. And, it's just sublime. It's just wonderful. And the pace. Whew. Now, if this film seems fast-paced to us today, imagine what it must have seemed like in 1940 to audiences then who were used to a much more even keel in the way movies unfolded. It must have hit them like a blur.
There's so much business happening. Mm. I mean, there are scenes with with multiple phone calls and multiple conversations that are happening at the same time. And when you're watching it, you're seeing that, oh, this is all one shot.
Yeah.
Like these people rehearsed this.
And so within an inch of its
within life. Within an inch of its life and knew the timing and had a great chemistry. And we get to witness it unfold. It's beautiful.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. And now – you referred to what we were just talking before as a meta movie, and in many ways
it is. Yeah.
In many ways it is. The casting, for instance, of – now, Cary Grant had never played a role like this. So that in itself was kind of an innovation, really.
You mean a comedic role?
No, he'd played comedy, but he hadn't played this kind of a character.
Like a little bit smarmy, a little unlikable, slightly unlikable.
Right. And this – created a template for Rosalind Russell and that she kept using for the next 15 years, trying to find material as good as this and usually failing.
Mm-hmm.
She was always good, but this material is the one time that she was backed up. Well, casting Ralph Bellamy. Now, Ralph Bellamy had already played a versatile stage actor, came out to Hollywood and was was kind of a utility leading man and second lead. Talented actor, not a very charismatic actor, but a talented actor, very capable actor. But he played the ultimate hayseed idiot in The Awful Truth with Cary Grant.
Yeah, he's some guy from Oklahoma.
Irene Dunne, yes. And he was so good in that role and played it totally straight, never winked at the audience once. He's just a believable character as this dense – nice but dense hayseed.
Naive.
So Hawks cannily cast him again with Cary Grant again in His Girl Friday, playing essentially the same role.
Well, he looks so good getting outsmarted by Cary Grant in both of those movies. He's really good at being like, what are you talking about? And he never drops a beat.
No. And he's such a bozo.
Bozo is an understatement.
Now, one of the other things about this movie is the cast. And I don't just mean the stars. Every single role, filled by a perfectly chosen character actor. This is like a parade. If you want to do a who's who of great supporting actors and comedic actors, you just line up all the people in this movie.
Okay.
And a lot of these names don't have any resonance today. But if you're an old movie nut, you know them all. Gene Lockhart, who plays the sheriff, Porter Hall, the hawk-faced guy with the mustache, one of the reporters, Ernest Truex, who plays Bendiger, Cliff Edwards, who was really a best-selling recording artist in the 20s and 30s, who introduced the song Singing in the Rain in movies and then was the voice of Jiminy Cricket. But here he's a character actor playing one of the wise guy reporters. Roscoe Carnes, another great, wonderful actor. Frank Jenks, Regis Toomey. They're all great.
Gene Lockhart is the only name I recognized.
Then you have Clarence Kolb, who plays the utterly corrupt mayor.
Okay.
And he was a vaudeville veteran. You have Abner Biberman, who plays Louis.
That's the best name ever.
Yes. He became a director later.
Okay.
He plays Louis, the henchman. Helen Mack, who plays Molly. John Quaylen, one of the most versatile character actors, who often did dialect roles. He did a lot of Scandinavian dialect roles. But here he's just playing the mousy Earl Williams, a man who's condemned to death. And
gets desperate a little.
Yes. The cast just goes on and on and on and on. And again, you show this lineup of people to anybody who's an old movie nut, they can name them off. I'm not the only one who feels this way about these people. There's one person who gives me special pleasure to watch in this movie, and that's Billy Gilbert. Billy Gilbert was the first actor I ever met on my very first trip to Hollywood because I loved him so much and I got a contact information for him. I grew up watching him because he was in a lot of films with Laurel and Hardy. He was in a number of the Little Rascals, our gang comedies. He was on a TV show I used to adore when I was a kid called Andy's Gang, hosted by Andy Devine. He was a wonderfully funny guy. He had a comic shtick where he did a comedic sneeze routine, which got him the role of Sneezy in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Okay.
And he could play any nationality. He played Greeks. He played Italians. He played all sorts of ethnics. But here he plays just a mild-mannered dope named Joe Pettibone, who shows up to, at a crucial moment in the film, to deliver an equally crucial piece of paper, which we won't reveal what it is because it'll spoil the plot, and is given a snow job by the corrupt mayor and the corrupt sheriff. And he's clueless. He's so hilariously clueless as to what they're trying to do to him. And it's just a wonderfully funny performance. Well, Billy told me, Billy's wife remembered all of his anecdotes. Billy had had a stroke, but Billy's wife, Ella, remembered all of his show business anecdotes. And she said that Howard Hawks said to the other actors, "Listen, you guys, this is his scene. Yeah, don't crowd him."
Oh, nice, nice.
Hawks wanted him to have his moment, and he does. He does.
Yeah, you – oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And the other person I got to talk to about this film was Ralph Bellamy.
Yes.
Who told me that in terms of this lightning pace, that the only way that they could make it work was that the actors took their cues from like three words before the end of every sentence.
Mm.
Instead of waiting for Cary Grant to finish his line before speaking, he would take his cue three words ahead. And that would give that overlapping and, you know, never a wasted breath kind of feeling to the film.
Yeah, everyone lives in that frantic world.
The
world of news.
Oh, my gosh. It's very much a topical film, too. Lots of references to Reds and the Red Scare, communists, the Hitler, of course, and the Nazi regime. There's a mention of Mayor LaGuardia in New York having cleaned up New York City. There's a mention because all the politicians are so hopelessly corrupt. There's at one point where they have to do something because they can't lose the colored vote.
Yes. There's nothing I love more than hearing the word colored in a movie.
Now, oddly, one thing they couldn't do in this movie that they did in the original film, which was done before the production code, and that Billy Wilder reused when he made his version of the front page in 1974, is – that the character of Roy Bensinger, played by Ernest Truex, who had been a great stage star, is gay. Now, you didn't see a lot of gay characters in movies at that time, nor was it explained or made explicit. The only reference to it here is that Rosalind Russell says in passing to him that he can be the bridesmaid at her wedding.
Oh, okay.
But if you're not savvy to what's going on, you wouldn't know that there's anything to that remark. Well, there is something to the remark. That's a reference, a sidelong reference to what his character really is all about. David Wayne played him in the Billy Wilder version in 74 and played him very gay. So it's just fascinating to watch. It was made again, by the way, not well, in 1988 as Switching Channels.
My goodness.
With Burt Reynolds as the editor, Kathleen Turner in the Rosalind Russell role, and Christopher Reeve in the Ralph Bellamy part.
What?
Reset at a television news operation.
Okay.
Two words, don't bother.
Switch the channel.
Switch the channel. Oh, goodness. The to give credit where credit is due, Howard Hawks was on a roll at this time, just making one great film after another. He had just finished making Only Angels Have Wings with Cary Grant and Gene Arthur, which is one of the all-time great Hollywood movies. He had, just before that, Bringing Up Baby. He went on to make Sergeant York, Ball of Fire, Air Force, one bullseye after another. But this is such a standout.
Takes the cake.
He hired Charles Lederer to adapt the Hecht MacArthur play, and Lederer got help from Ben Hecht and from another great writer named Maury Riskin. So a lot of very talented people put together this peerless screenplay. Funny, funny, funny.
And a good story.
Oh, yes.
And there's a good story.
We
haven't said much about the story because the performances and the rhythm and the directing is so good. But that's the part that you get to experience when you watch the movie.
That's right. Because there are serious moments. There are serious moments, and you couldn't get away with those serious moments if they didn't create a believable enough structure and solid enough characters and situations that you would accept those serious moments as real. And you do. You absolutely do. Pretty great film.
It's a good lesson for writers.
One asterisk. This film fell into the public domain through accident.
Yeah, yeah.
And as did the 31 front page. And as a result, it's really hard to find really good copies of either one of those films. They're all over the internet. You can watch them for free.
Yeah, I watched it on Netflix, actually.
Yeah.
There's a version on Netflix. There's two versions on Amazon.
Yeah.
The kind of a bunch of different versions.
I watched a pretty good one on Amazon, but it had hesitations. There was, for some reason, there were little periodic blips in the soundtrack.
Mm.
But I called over to Sony because it's a Columbia picture. Sony owns it. They did release an official perfect DVD of it as part of a boxed carry grant set. So if you're someone who wants to own a perfect copy of His Girl Friday, and you should, that's the only way to get it, is part of that Cary Grant collection from Sony Home Entertainment.
And you should probably own that anyway if you're a Cary Grant fan.
Yeah. I wish there were an equally good copy of the 1931 front page directed by Lewis Milestone. That's worth knowing.
You know, it's long enough ago when one of the main actors was named Adolf. Like people were still naming themselves Adolf.
That's true. Well, all right. So we've said all we need to say about His Girl Friday. The only thing left to say is, what are you waiting for? Go watch it.
Don't wait till Friday.
Wait till the end of the podcast.
Maybe. Oh, okay. All right.
What do you think?
Yeah, wait till the end of the podcast, but not until Friday.
See it through with us. Well, our next film typically is not one we recommend. But you're onto that now, right? You ever watch HGTV?
Yeah.
You ever notice that people on those shows don't get the formula?
Yes.
We're going to show you this house that is perfect. This house has everything you want. Oh, by the way, it sells for $2 million.
What? How could that be?
What, they've never watched the channel?
Yeah, yeah.
They still don't get it? All right. By now, you guys should know that the second film we cover is a turkey. Well, guess what? We're doing it again in just a minute.
Now on Thursdays, from the founders of the ultimate industry screenwriting staple, The Blacklist, comes The Blacklist Table Reads, an exciting new podcast that takes the best screenplays Hollywood hasn't made yet and turns them into movies for your ears. Every month, The Blacklist Table Reads will be turning one script into four weekly episodes, complete with writer interviews from Blacklist founder Franklin Leonard, a fusion of classic radio theater with the most talked about scripts in Hollywood. Seriously, a truly unique listening experience. Their first script is the outrageously satirical comedy Balls Out by Malcolm Spellman, currently a producer on Empire, and Tim Talbot, winner of the 2015 Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award at Sundance, with the cast featuring Paul Scheer, Matt Walsh, Lauren Lapkus, Casey Wilson, and more. Ooh, and more is in that? I love and more. The Blacklist Table Reads, Thursdays on Wolf Pop. Welcome back to Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn.
That would be you.
I'm Baron Vaughn, you're Leonard Maltin, and yep. We're going to talk about a horrible movie now. with good people. Good people.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of good people. A lot of talent. A lot of talent, which just makes it all the more frustrating that this remake of RoboCop, a film we covered on this show.
Yes, we did.
A little while ago.
It was because it's a robot, quote-unquote robot movie. Got some emails saying, well, he's a cyborg. Calm down.
Yeah.
But the original RoboCop is brilliant. This one?
Not so brilliant.
Yes.
I have a little habit when a movie gets remade. One of the things I look at first after I've seen the movie is I compare the running times. Now, this is not foolproof and it's very arbitrary, but the original RoboCop, which we love, was 102 minutes long. It seemed to do the job, right?
Yeah.
There was nothing missing.
Yeah, definitely.
Nothing given short shrift. The new one, 117 minutes long. Now, why? Because they had more to do, they had a better story to tell, because they created more compelling characters. Why? Again, it's arbitrary, I know. It's arbitrary. It's not about length. It's about quality of content.
But you're saying that the original RoboCop achieved what it achieved in 102 minutes.
Yep.
Which is not even a two-hour movie.
Nope.
About an hour, 42 minutes.
Yep.
But that's a lot, you know, and they achieved a lot. So this movie was 115?
Yeah.
So 5 minutes shy. Yeah. 117. 3 minutes shy of 2 hours. And
a couple of bushels shy
yeah.
of being a good movie.
But it begs the question, well, that's the wrong way to use that expression, but the question is, what did they add?
Yeah.
What extra 15 minutes did they see as like, we gotta put this in there? We fixed RoboCop,
guys. We fixed RoboCop, which wasn't broken. Oh, dear. Well, you know, you got a good cast. Joel Kinnaman.
Yeah. Or Joel Kinnaman for the Swedish fans.
Plays the main character who becomes the RoboCop.
Yeah. Very good actor. He was on The Killing. You might have known him from that.
Gary Oldman, needs no introduction, plays one of the few, maybe the only sympathetic character besides RoboCop in the movie. A doctor, a research scientist who is working on these robotic experiments. Michael Keaton, who we love.
Mm-hmm.
Plays the bad guy.
A
corporate bad guy. Get this, a corporate bad guy. Think of that. And no subtlety in that characterization or in the way it was written. Abby Cornish plays Joel Kinnaman's wife. Jackie Earle Haley, Michael Kenneth Williams, Jennifer Eel, Marion Jean-Baptiste.
Great cast.
Jay Baruchel and Samuel L. Jackson, who opens the movie. With a new framing device that they came up with for this film, of him playing a rather pompous, obnoxious TV host, hosts a show called The Novak Element, where he pontificates about various things.
And he coins the phrase robophobic, which I feel like I heard over and over in all the trailers.
Why is America robophobic? Yes. Because they saw this movie. That's why they're robophobic. Now, I think the key difference between the really good, really successful original film, which holds up so well, and this one is that the original film was essentially a black comedy and sets its tone right away, right at the beginning, of being absurd. It's a perverse, absurd satire, social satire. This film is a little cocky. It thinks it's being a social satire, but it doesn't have it doesn't deliver the goods. And in a sense, it's unsuccessful as well because it's a little too real.
It's severe.
It's severe because this is too close to reality and it's uncomfortable to watch at times. Without that layer of absurdity, it's presenting a reality both on the streets of Tehran at the beginning of the film and on the streets of Detroit, where most of the story takes place, that's not only unpleasant to watch, but downright off-putting.
Disheartening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They missed the whole point. They missed the whole point.
Well, they are trying to wrap it around our priorities of the day. And our priorities of the day are kind of messed up. And the priorities of what the movie industry wants to do with movies can be a little messed up as well. So it's like, I feel like the original RoboCop's appeal is that they really do go for that ridiculousness.
Yeah.
And that silliness and that absurdity. And it kind of makes you go, wow, this is incredible. What an indictment.
Yeah.
And this one is more of a, like, it just doesn't go that far. It doesn't go there.
It seems strange to say they should have pushed harder or gone further. But if you see the original film, you know what we're talking about, because that film is just so ballsy. It's Paul Verhoeven, the Dutch director, not noted for subtlety. That's not his strong suit. And boy, does it hit you between the eyes.
Yeah. But this RoboCop is a RoboFlop. Hey, that's what I was looking for.
Yeah. The director is a Brazilian director who comes out of documentaries and who had made a couple of very well-received action films called The Elite Squad.
Okay.
And a sequel to The Elite Squad. And it's a very hard-driving action filmmaking about an elite police detail.
About a squad that's elite?
Well, yes.
Okay.
At war with drug lords in Brazil. And I think that's what attracted the producers of the studio behind this film to hire him. And this is his American debut. His name is Jose Padilla. I hope I pronounced that right. And, he did his best, but it's the script. I really think it's the script.
Yeah, you can get a good director, but if you have a poopy script, you can only go so far, especially if you aren't open to changing things, which I guess there may have been some gripes.
There's some scuttlebutt online about him trying to present new ideas and the studio shutting him down.
Of course, we never know what of those things are true or not. Yeah. People try to cover their butts after their movie comes out. And
By the way, I don't remember in my critics dictionary poopy being an adjective that I was supposed to use.
You know, I think if critics used poopy a lot more, people would listen.
Oh, maybe so.
Yeah.
Maybe so. Anyway, don't bother with RoboCop. See the original RoboCop.
Some good action sequences.
Oh, yeah, there are. There are. Again, this he knows how to do. This director knows how to do. And some good performances, too. Gary Oldman's very good. You know, this is a talented cast. So, again, it's not their doing.
It's just one of those things where the puzzle pieces don't fit together.
Yeah, yeah. But we got a better one, though. Uh-oh. Got a better movie to recommend. And an interesting one. A very intriguing one, in fact. And by the way, it's the same running time as the original.
Ah-ha-ha-ha.
I'm not saying that this is an infallible way of judging things. But sometimes it is.
Okay.
We'll be back in a minute.
Hey, everybody. This is Baron Vaughn. I want to remind you of a great way that you can help support the show and Earwolf / Wolf Pop at the exact same time. And that is through Amazon. You guys know Amazon? Amazon. Amazon.com. I'm not talking about warrior ladies. I'm talking about the website. Since you hopefully love Maltin the Movies at Baron Vaughn, here's a way that you can love both us and Amazon at the exact same time. Next time you go to shop at Amazon, don't go to Amazon.com. That's for losers. Instead, go to wolfpop.com/Amazon. That'll take you to the same Amazon you know and love, and all the prices will be great Amazon.com prices you know and love, but we get a sweet, sweet kickback. So you don't have to pay an extra dime, but Maltin Movies at Baron Vaughn gets credit from Amazon. And it really adds up and helps us keep the engineers happy and the microphones well-oiled and greased for us to use them on the podcast. So remember, go to wolfpop.com/Amazon and bookmark that so that every time you need to buy batteries for your Kindle or batteries for your television or batteries for your cardigans, you can go to that website. And it's a great place to get some last-minute presents for your loved ones on your birthday or their birthday. You know, you should get presents for people on your birthday. I mean, they're the ones who help you stay alive. Use our special link and help us earn some cash at the exact same time. That's wolfpop.com/Amazon. Huzzah.
Welcome back. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Yes, we are remaking last week's podcast. I don't know what we're doing. We're talking about reboots.
We're talking about remakes.
We have talked about His Girl Friday so far and the remake of RoboCop. Poopy, I believe we all agree.
Yeah.
But this next movie, quality.
Now, there's a long history of foreign films, foreign language films, being adapted by Hollywood. This goes back again, you know, many, many decades. It's not a new idea. It was done in the 30s. Intermezzo, great film that introduced Ingrid Bergman to Hollywood, was a remake of a Swedish film she'd already made. Billy Wilder turns to an old German film to make Some Like It Hot. In the 70s and 80s, Three Men and a Baby was based on a big hit French movie. Even The Birdcage, Mike Nichols' The Birdcage, is a very successful Americanization of La Cage aux Folles.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Which is a great movie, too.
I always forget that. Related.
Again, there's no rule. There's no rule that says you can't come up with as good a movie as the original. Sometimes I do feel it's kind of superfluous or even pointless to do this. When I saw David Fincher's American remake of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, having seen the Swedish original, I said, well, why'd they bother? It's essentially the same movie.
Yeah.
And, the reason they bothered is that most Americans won't see a film with subtitles.
Yeah, and I know a director who told me – he was in the Academy. That's how he introduced himself. Hi, I'm in the Academy. Not really. But he was talking about – because Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was up for a lot of things, and he was saying that he personally likes the Swedish version better, mainly because they didn't have the big fat budget that Fincher had, and they had to problem solve and be resourceful, and he thought it turned into a better movie. I feel like a big thing is distance, like how much space is there between the original and the remake. So with this movie, not a lot of distance.
No, we're about to talk about Let Me In.
Yes.
In 2010, which is a remake of an incredible Swedish movie called Let the Right One In.
Except in Swedish.
Yes. Now, I, like you, have an aversion to modern horror films because I'm a wimp. I don't.
Oh, I just think they're lazy most of the time.
Well, we can argue that or debate that as well. I'm too squeamish. I'm just too squeamish. And so I don't seek out, and in fact, I try to actively avoid most contemporary horror films. I like gothic horror. I like ghost stories. I like eerie films. But I don't like what is called horror or torture porn horror, like Saw.
Torture porn, I think, is a better term. I don't want to see people get tortured. I want a story with some characters in
it. So I tend to stay away. But when this Swedish movie opened called Let the Right One In, I started hearing things from people, some of my friends and colleagues saying, oh, you got to see this movie. This movie's incredible. So I actually did seek this one out, and I'm so glad I did. And it's not that it isn't
scary,
graphic
at
times, and scary and riveting. It's all of those things, but it's also fascinating and original and intriguing.
It's well done.
It's well done. It's such a provocative idea for a movie. I mean, we've seen so much vampire now. Vampires are practically an epidemic in pop culture these days.
And that's the thing is, how do you reinvent the wheel when it comes to vampires? And I would say, and this is what these movies do, you don't have to explain vampires to us.
Yeah.
We already know the rules. Do it in an interesting way.
Right. Even though they tend to keep reinventing those rules.
Yeah, they do. They do. But sometimes that's fun. It can be fun. It can be effective.
Well, here, I don't know where to begin. Matt Reeves wrote and directed this remake. He's the guy who created Felicity, and that's where he started working with Joss Whedon, and made a very impressive feature debut with Cloverfield.
Yeah, I was in that.
Were you?
Yeah, for 5 seconds.
I missed you.
Yes, I was in it for 5 seconds.
Yeah, I looked the other way. I looked down. I grabbed some popcorn. I missed you.
I had a big afro. That's all I'll say. And I was in the beginning of the movie.
Well, Cloverfield was a very attention-getting debut, obviously.
Yes, it was.
And then he got to do this. And I would say this is as good a remake, as good an Americanization or an American translation of a foreign film as I've ever seen by anybody. It's that solid. It's that faithful to the original material without being hampered by it. It's not, you know, he's not hindered by it.
Right. I mean, it's like he is doing a tribute to the essence of the original film, but not trying to copy it as much as he's trying to put it in a different place.
So what is this about? Okay. This is an R-rated film, lest anyone be
R misled. For
yeah. By the way, one of the problems I think with the new RoboCop, just going back half a turn, is that it's a PG-13 movie.
Because they wanted that broader audience.
And I think maybe that harder edge of an R might have helped the film.
Possibly.
If they had a better script. Anyway, but this one is an R-rated movie and deserves to be because it's pretty full-blooded.
Uh-oh. Cold-blooded.
Cold-blooded and full-blooded.
Winter, the entire movie.
Cody Smith McPhee, what a talented young actor.
Yeah.
First time I saw him, he'd been working in Australian television, but the first time I became aware of him was in The Road. He was chosen to play opposite Viggo Mortensen in The Road.
That's why I recognize him. Yes. Okay.
He's a very gifted young actor. And this film requires so much of him, demands so much of him. He plays a kind of a mousy high school student who feels isolated in every way, physically, emotionally. He lives with his mom, his soon-to-be-divorced mom, who's a working mom and not always there for him, at a rather uninteresting apartment complex on the outskirts of town.
Los Alamos, New Mexico, my birth state.
And he clearly has no friends. And when you see him at school, you also learn that he is being bullied. There are a couple of kids at school who just torment him. And there doesn't seem to be anything he can do about that. One night, he notices some new neighbors moving in to the apartment, next door, in fact. a girl and a man he guesses is her father. And it turns out that there's more to the story than that. And the girl turns up, he just sits by himself at night on this kind of jungle gym.
Yeah, this is like a courtyard in the middle of the apartment complex.
And one night the girl is just there as he is there. And the first thing she says to him is, I can't be your friend. They're the same age. They're 12. But she says, I can't be your friend. And of course, it's a very leading thing to say. And he says, why? And she can't explain. The reason is she's a vampire.
Oh, yep. SpaghettiOs.
Yep. And she's played by Chloe Grace Moretz in a very good performance. Very, very modulated performance. Really interesting. I read an interview with Matt Reeves where he said that he wanted it to be clear that even though she is a vampire who has lived for many, many years, in her human form, she's still a little girl and vulnerable and sort of susceptible to wanting some socialization and wanting to have a friend. She would love to have a friend. The intelligent part of her brain knows that that's a bad idea. It's a fundamentally bad idea for her to reach out to another human being, a normal human being. But she's tempted to do so because she's lonely.
Because this vampire has a heart.
That's right. And he's there, and he's receptive to her. But there are a lot of other things going on too. He's in a household that's fraught with tension because his mom and dad have split up, and it's not been an amicable split. He feels isolated at school. All these things are going on. And then he's a curious guy. He's a bit of a voyeur.
Yeah, he's got a little what do they call it? Telescopes. He's looking out his window at neighbors, seeing some things he maybe shouldn't see.
Yep. And he's curious about her, about the new neighbor, and what's going on. Well, what's going on is not pretty because she needs blood. She needs a lot of blood to survive. And the man who's with her, who is not her father.
Played by the excellent Richard Jenkins.
Richard Jenkins, one of my favorites. The most unusual role of his career.
Yeah, yeah.
Has to go out and get fresh meat, so to speak. He's got to get her hearty supplies of blood on a regular basis. And this is where the film gets grisly. And not gratuitously graphic, I don't think, but necessarily graphic to show you what's really going on. And tracking all of this, trying to make sense of this, is a local police detective played by Elias Koteas, the very talented Canadian actor.
Yes, Casey Jones from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies. Mm-hmm. The old ones.
And so there's a lot of factors, a lot of story ingredients being woven together here, and so well woven together. It's a mesmerizing movie. Did you find that?
I did. It's a good story by a good storyteller, Matt Reeves. It unfolds in a very interesting way. You really get into the relationships of the characters, especially the two children, one child, one immortal. But that's what separates it from, I think, most horror movies. And that's true with the original movie as well, that we get into the minds of these children and the performances that what's the other kid's name? The first one, the boy?
Cody.
His name's Cody. Cody and Chloe. Their performances are nuanced.
Yes.
And you feel the connection that they have. And it raises the stakes, and that's how you make a movie. You have good characters and a good story. Things happen.
If you like foreign films, as I do, you might want to watch the original Swedish film, Let the Right One In, directed by Thomas Alfredson, which was adapted by John Lindquist from his own novel. So this is originally a novel.
Okay.
The novelist made the screenplay, and a very good screenplay, which is the basis for Matt Reeves' retread here. Is it better than the American? Maybe slightly. Or maybe it's just that I saw that one first, so there were no surprises for me, in this one. And maybe it's also that there is a kind of an exoticness to it being a foreign country and a foreign location and a foreign language that makes it somehow more intriguing than something set here, right, at home in the States.
Well, New Mexico is the land of enchantment.
That's
one of the few states that doesn't have state in the description of its state. Mm-hmm. It's not the golden state. It's the land of enchantment.
But either way, you can't go wrong. Either way, you can't go wrong. Incidentally, Matt Reeves, who's gone on to make Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, rehired Cody Smith McPhee as one of the co-stars of that movie. So they've got a good working relationship,
okay,
to be sure. And this is just a really skillful film. A great music score by Michael Giacchino, who has three blockbusters in a row in theaters this summer, but who once told me that he never works on R-rated films. And in order to do this one, I think as a favor to Matt Reeves, he said he had to keep closing his eyes while he was scoring the movie.
Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly.
And piano.
Yeah. But he's a talented guy. So there we are. There we are. Another interesting lineup of films. People ask us to repeat the titles, so we're going to repeat the titles. We started today with His Girl Friday.
His Girl Friday. Yes, Your Girl Friday? No, it's My Girl Friday. Okay, it's his.
Yes, that His Girl Friday. Try to find a good copy. Don't suffer through a bad one. If you're watching a crummy one.
A crummy one still might be pretty good, though.
Well, the content is always going to be great.
Yeah.
You just want to get the best looking, best sounding version you can. Then there's that remake of RoboCop, which is RoboBad.
RoboFlop.
Yep. And then there's Let Me In, the very fine remake of the Swedish film Let the Right One In. So those are two strong recommendations and one recommendation to avoid out of today's show on remakes. And I'm sure we'll cover this territory again.
Yeah, we'll reboot this.
We'll remake the remake.
We'll remake episode. The remake episode, yeah.
All right. I guess we can.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime. We make the rules here.
We make the remakes. The rules that we make. Okay.
And other than watching you on the new Netflix series Grace and Frankie with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin and Sam Waterston and Martin Sheen.
Yes.
Which people are, I'm sure, streaming even as we speak.
Possibly.
Where can they find you between now and the next podcast?
Well, I'm on Twitter. I'm BARVONBLAQ. And also, if you are in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I'm going to be at the Amphibian Stage, which is in Fort Worth, on June 5th and 6th. And then also Rubber Gloves in Denton, Texas, on June 7th. If you like live comedy, and I hope you do, come check out Baron Vaughn, Hootie Hootie Hoo. What about you, Leonard?
I have no upcoming gigs that I can promote here.
You do great with jokes.
Well, I'm on Twitter at Leonard Maltin, and I'm online at leonardmaltin.com. And I always enjoy hearing from you, as we both enjoy hearing from you. We love your comments. We love your feedback. We really, really appreciate you telling your friends about the show, because we want to stay on
the air.
Whatever air is now, how do you redefine air in the podcast?
It's all air.
It's all air. Anyhow, we love doing it. We hope you enjoy listening to it. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big money.